Hey, it's Kyle Meredith, host of the Kyle Meredith With podcast, presented by WFPK at WFPK.org and the Consequence Podcast Network. It's a series that puts the spotlight on iconic musicians and actors, inviting them to drop by and talk about their latest projects, whether it's albums, TV shows, films, or beyond.
I'm going to say something I don't want to say. Here it goes. Without Spinal Tap, there is no Tenacious D.
Whoa. Man.
We get great stories and the biggest scoops from people like Garbage's Shirley Manson, the 1975's Matty Healy, Jack Black and Kyle Gass of Tenacious D, Maya Hawke, Kiefer Sutherland, and everyone in between. New episodes arrive every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones. You can find Kyle Meredith With on the Consequence Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
Gogo Bordello formed in New York in the late 90s. The members came from all over the world and brought with them a variety of instruments, like the violin, accordion, horns. But the band is distinctly American in that they are a group of people with different backgrounds blending their culture together to create something new. The group's leader, Eugene Hoots, a Ukrainian refugee, specifically sees Gogo Bordello as a punk band. And though it isn't punk like the Ramones or Black Flag, it is very much a punk project in its essence of how they approach music and the energy they bring to the stage. Today, we talk to Eugene, dig into the group's history and philosophy, and we understand what role ska plays in the upbeat, bouncy sounds of Gogo Bordello.
So I like the idea of this kind of immigrant punk band.
Mm-hmm.
These, you know, people coming from all different places and coming together and playing punk together. I think that's a really interesting way to partner yourselves together to make music.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess that's what Gogo Bordello was from the very beginning. I remember when I first heard them, I was just totally blown away by how it was just all of these different styles of music,
mm-hmm.
particularly with sort of like a Eastern European folk sound to it, but just punk.
Yeah.
Just energy.
Yeah. The thing that was always expressed to me was their insane live shows. And Eugene's ferocity as a front person to just get into, you know, huge swirling audiences and command a crowd.
I think the other thing too about them, particularly their live show back in the day, is just their usage of these different instruments
mm-hmm.
and embracing them in a way where it's not at all novelty. It is just you're playing these instruments. You're attacking these instruments, you're using them for all getting the sounds and the energy you can get from them and creating interesting music that's punk rock.
Yeah, there's no reason punk rock just has to be loud guitars and banging drums, right?
Yeah.
Whatever you're playing, bring it to the party.
And Gogo Bordello, particularly because of these influences, there's always been like this upbeat element to it.
Yeah.
Which is a ska component.
Or is it just a beat that internationally recognized as making your body want to move?
This is something we talk about at length in this interview.
Yep.
I want to talk first about this song Focus Coin, which one of your new songs off your new album. You released it like a little while ago. When I heard it, I was like, oh my goodness. This is there. Gogo Bordello officially is playing ska.
Good. That's the plan. But if you browse through our albums, you'll find a lot of that from the very beginning.
Sure, I mean, sure.
It's like ska without doing ska. Yeah, even my previous bands, ska and hardcore, they go hand to hand. They never were not going hand to hand.
Yeah.
And ska and punk was never like separated. And I can probably write up a whole list of songs that have semi-ska or pretty blatant ska elements. So yeah, there's no contradiction there. I always felt like, you know, Operation Ivy and Murphy's Law and, you know, especially early OE and punk and, you know, ska bands from England were just like living and breathing it.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think the marriage of ska and punk happened pretty quick back in the two-tone era. And I just don't think they've been separated ever since.
Yeah, exactly. So Well, I'm glad that, you know, I'm glad it's working out for you.
The song is about the sort of how our focus is an important thing that's being, I guess you could say, attacked in this era of many, many distractions.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say about this particular song?
Yeah, for sure. Where, I mean, it's kind of, you know, the last couple of years were pretty trying years for everyone on the planet. And now with, you know, pandemic, now war in Ukraine is going on. And, you know, Russian propaganda just is thriving on this people disability to focus. You know, it's actually their main tactic is make their statements unintelligible, and so people just kind of get used to not having a satisfying answer, and they already drilled their population into it. Like people that are don't even care about satisfying answer, they're already in the whole Russian territory. It's pretty apparent that people are okay just gobbling up whatever garbage they're served, and they've been trained for so many decades. I should say actually centuries, because they've always been basically one or another form of dictatorship there, whether it's communistic or tsarist or Ivan the Terrible. That's like almost secondary. It's always dictatorship of one or another kind. And I think that people that are pretty much trained into not having any kind of analytically satisfying answers at this point, and that's a kind of threat to the that tendency is worldwide too, you know. So you got to kind of catch yourself and start developing or rather recapturing your ability to hyper focus. Because in fact, like any spiritual teaching that there ever was, from basic meditation to like deeper, you know, things like, you know, whatever Sufism or whatever discipline you may pursue, they all point back that, you know, your attention, your ability to strengthen your focusing and your inner core is really the only way you can perceive things adequately in this world. So you see, it's very much under attack. And so the song actually plays off on like kind of the gibberish that you hear around, about whatever the issues are going on around the world. And it's just kind of portrays them as a kind of avalanche of lies. And you just gotta catch yourself and be like, hey, that is an avalanche of lies.
I think like one of the biggest problems we face today as a culture is apathy. And I think distraction and lack of focus feeds apathy.
Yeah.
So I think that's an interesting point you were making, because I think to get people to care and do something, they do need to focus.
Yeah. I mean, it's more than they just have to focus for focus sake. It's just, they will not be able to have their daily operation structured in an adequate way. Their priorities will be upside down, and they will unfortunately not live their maximum potential life. Without getting into too deep about that, it's like it's segued into a pretty, you know, if maybe like 20, 30 years ago, that would be considered to be kind of like conspiracy theory or something like that kind of mentality. But now it's kind of segued into a pretty casual way of just the way people operate, like through social media. It's like superficiality is completely accepted on all levels, and actually it's glorified. Like narcissism is glorified, as if that's not a malignant trait. It's just like, yeah, let's get more of that done, you know. It's just kind of absurd.
Yeah.
How these things that were pretty much understood as negative things Now they're just completely full blown and celebrated. Mm-hmm. Narcissistic mentality, very, you know, just get ahead no matter what, get as many followers as you can no matter what. It's just like, that's what people's life became about, and a lot, not all, but you know, a lot of them. And that is really, really not punk rock.
Yeah, definitely not.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, used to, we're trying to lose followers, you know what I mean? Just like, you know, like, it was just like, okay, we're doing something that's not for everybody. And if you dig it, you dig it, but we're not expecting everybody to dig it. And so don't dig it, you know, if you don't dig it, like, that's fine.
Yeah, it was never about begging people to like it. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was great because you didn't have to spend so much of your time like dealing with people who are there for superficial reasons or actually there for wrong reasons, you know. So it's definitely quite a curve.
Your new drummer from 2020 to present is Corey Kingston Horn.
Yes, that's the man.
Yes, so let's talk about his... he played in the original, he was original Agrolites drummer.
Yep.
Rhythm Doctors was a band that predated the Agrolites. He's done some stuff with Tim Armstrong.
Yes, Tim's solo album, yeah.
Yeah.
Poets Life. What a great album.
Yeah. Western Times Ska Orchestra, which is an amazing project. C-Spot, a traditional LA ska band. And then he's done some stuff with Hepcat too. Though in particular, though, because he played on Agrolites' debut album, Dirty Reggae.
Mm-hmm.
If you listen to that record, those are just some deep, deep grooves.
Oh, it's badass.
Yeah.
It's just, it's absolutely badass. And I beat it to death, some of the tracks from there on my DJ set. And yeah, I mean, I know Corey for quite a number of years, actually, because he was friends with our previous drummer, Oliver Charles. And Fredo, Alfredo Ortiz, who also played with us. I mean, they're kind of like, you know, they're all from same scene, you know, LA, San Diego, punk rock, ska, fusion. It seems like they share as diverse as all their influences are. It seemed like punk rock and ska.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, all three of them nailed that. And Corey in particular, he kind of, I would say he even specializes in, I mean, he does specialize in ska. So it's like ska and punk rock. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was great because as you pointed out before, you know, like that element is not new for us, even in my previous bands, like before Gogol Bordello in the Cossacks, and even in my band back in Ukraine in Uksusnik, ska was kind of like one of the places to go. Like it was, I almost forgot the word ska because it was just like it was always there at the tip of our fingers as one of the grooves that's gonna slip into just about any song anytime.
Yeah,
but Corey, since he has such a, you know, knack for it, and he's kind of a scientist of it, he kind of brought in a new feeling of it into the band and actually inspired some of these songs to be in a very particular way. So maybe that's why it stood out to you. Like he just really, really fire breathed it. He just spits fires it, you know.
I think so, because you know, not every upbeat is ska. I mean, obviously, you know, the Romani folk music and other thing, it has a similar upbeat sound, but the drumming of ska is unique, and I think that's probably what I heard listening to Focus Coin was the drumming, and that's why it caught my attention.
Right, so that it's more so than previous incorporations of that. I can see that for sure. Because as you said, yes, they're in gypsy music, in Eastern European music, there are grooves that are basically, on, if you don't get it under microscope, they could be considered like very, very ska.
Yeah.
But it's, of course, it's that nuance, that whole like washing machine, that whole vibe that makes it the ska, you know? So, yeah.
I mean, to so many of the uninitiated, you know, they hear ska and they think, what is this, you know, polka or mariachi? And all of them have that same upbeat element.
Right.
But they're all a little bit different.
Very super different. And I mean, even the Latin ska, like the way Latin punk rock bands do it, you know, down in Argentina and in Colombia, you know, Scampida was a great punk ska band we played with. We're always really good friends with. They do have their own feeling of it. It's really, really kind of, how would I say it? It's more of a stabbing kind of staccato feel, perhaps more aggressive too. But it is quite distinctly different, yes.
What do you think is the universal appeal of the upbeat?
Well, I mean, people do want to levitate somehow. I mean, you know,
I love that.
And you know, it's endorphins. I mean, you know, body produces endorphins. What, like after 20 minutes of movement, of intense movement, and then it becomes more than. I mean, you're not just thinking that you're having fun. You're having a lot of fun because your body is pumping chemicals that are painkillers.
Yeah.
And that's the universal appeal of upbeat. It's a painkiller producing machine mechanism. You know, who doesn't like pain being killed?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, as human being, you know, it's no secret, no matter how well you're doing, you know, or maybe you're going through one of the, you know, whether you're in the hills or valleys of your life, there is still something that you're resolving or dealing with. It's still some kind of form of semi-suffering or maybe full-blown suffering. And, you know, all those things that people latch on to is whether it's, you know, drugs or alcohol or better music, you know, those are ways to medicate yourself and get yourself out of these problems and feel better. So, of course, pumping so much natural, I forgot the names of those endorphins, but at one point I was like studying it, kind of was so curious about it. But that's the story, you know, that's the appeal. It kills your pain.
I love it.
Because it developed in different parts of the world independently, like the stuff happening in Eastern Europe and Jamaican ska music and mariachi music.
Yeah.
I mean, these things were not aware. They were not aware of each other, but they were, it's like they found the secret, and the secret was the upbeats.
I love that ethno, like anthropological musicologist kind of way of looking at those things and connecting the dots. Like, I always enjoyed that. So what would be like unifying thread between the upbeat of, you know, Jamaican ska and Eastern European and Latin music, you know. You know, the reasons are climate and socio-political and history, you know. Those are probably the things that make those particular territories so rich with that kind of music.
Sure.
Because those are very tough areas to survive, you know, maybe not on first glimpse, but they are, you know, those are, that's usually where there's a lot of poverty, a lot of unresolved history. And, you know, that's kind of, I mean, Eastern Europe and Latin America has that in common, that's for sure. And, you know, I mean, and Jamaica is not so far behind. I mean, you know, there's just a lot of tensions that constantly need being resolved.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's how people subconsciously create those mechanisms of self-healing, you know. Even in tribal times, I mean, just dancing around the fire that predates music, that when it was probably more just movement, probably rhythm appeared out of the dancing, not the other way around. So it was already, you know, the link, we just found the link back into, you know, pumping those endorphins and getting high natural.
When start wearing purple, I imagine that any show you play, no matter how the crowd's been, when you go into that song, that no one's capable of not moving.
You're not wrong about that.
that song just like seeps into your bones and it just demands movement.
Yeah. Well, that's actually that song is kind of found perfect marriage of Eastern European vibe, in fact, and ska reggae element, which is pretty prominent in the arrangement there. It just was such a natural, you know, way to arrange that song, which is very Odessa, Black Sea, Ukrainian kind of storytelling little ditty to begin with, you know. But to me, it's a very kind of Black Sea Ukrainian kind of song with a bit of that port town, Odessa being such a port town that, you know, received so much, was so well informed by tango and Italian melodies that were, you know, popular with the sailors back in, you know, 19th century and early 20th century. A lot of those melodies that Gardel sang, you know, the tango melodies and Italian mafia songs, Neapolitan songs, they all kind of found a home in Odessa and were later kind of regurgitated onto the whole Ukraine and farther. And a lot of people, a lot of times people identify with those melodies as if it's a folkloric melodies of that land, but they're actually of, you know, a lot of times they're from Italian and Spanish origin. Yeah, it's really interesting stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they do take on character of their new locale and like become the melodies of their new area. But their origin, I mean, I've scouted through a lot of those tango songs and to hear so many familiar, supposedly, you know, Ukrainian Odessa songs, melodies.
We'll be right back after this.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you did the Tiny Desk in, when was that, like 2010 maybe?
Yeah, something like that.
Watching you, it was a great set. I loved hearing the songs in that acoustic setting. You closed with Start Wearing Purple and, you know, you're on the desk and it feels like you had been really trying to break down the NPR staff to kind of like let go their inhibitions. And I feel like it feels like you've got them on that song.
Well, I mean, we could have easily started with that song and get it there, but in a way that would be just too banal. You know what I mean? Like,
sure,
here we go. Here we go. You know, I mean, it's nice to see the arch of developments, you know, and in a way, you know, it's funny, but there was like 5 or 6 years where we like just didn't play that song. Like we just completely get rid of it and kind of moved past it. We toured for ages without Start Wearing Purple and then brought it back. Maybe it's like kind of unthinkable for some people, but it worked just fine without it too.
You recently went to Ukraine.
Yeah.
You just got back and you were playing a secret undisclosed location show for Ukrainian troops. Is that what you were doing there?
Yes, that would be accurate to say.
Yeah, what was that like? I mean, I saw a little collection video where it was kind of summarizing the thing, and it, you know, it looked like it was a very powerful experience.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to say about it. I'm still processing the experience. And, you know, since the beginning of this completely idiotic attack of Russia, which is kind of so moronic and on so many levels, it's just such a huge miscalculation of who they think they are, you know. And you know, of course, everyone I know and you know is been betaken by the situation and betaken by it on a very deep level. So you know, you kind of gear up for to be a part of solution as much as you can be in and kind of be that as in a most almost like pragmatic way, because it is so emotionally you know, what's the right word, kind of almost damaging, you know. But luckily Ukrainian people are strong and they just persevere, and you know, and as one of the Ukrainian people, you know, you find a way to, okay, emotions aside, what can be really done? You know, this is not the time to you know, get hysterical. This is time to get practical. And you know, morale is very important. So writing poems and songs and putting them out on, you know, YouTube and promoting them, that's a one thing. That to me just like we did a lot of that, and they created some collaborations with other like, you know, artists from Ukraine that we thought were very meaningful and powerful. You know, but at a certain point that start felt like it's got to get more tangible, and like we got to go there. And I mean, here in Gogol Bordello, we always kind of put our, what's the expression,
you put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah, that's the expression. Yeah, sorry, it just escaped my mind. So it was time to do that, you know, because people there, they hear constantly about how people all over the world support Ukraine. But, you know, when you really see it, when somebody is coming from afar, whether it's just an organization of people flies in and, you know, meets them face to face, that's a different result. They feel it differently. They really feel it and they really appreciate it. And, you know, and it was important for us to do it because a lot of actors been going there. You know, a friend of mine, Liev Schreiber, has been going there a lot. I mean, Ben Stiller, Angelina Jolie, like people been going there. You know, Sean Penn has been doing a lot of amazing work for that. But it's harder for musicians. It's a lot more people. It's, you know, a band is a band. It's band with a crew is always going to be end up like 10 people. It's a lot more logistics. It's wartime. It's not easy. And plus some people are just scared to go, you know, and understandably so. So it was important to kind of break that mold, you know, and go there as a band and show that, yes, you can go. And, you know, provided it's all professionally organized and, you know, it's not the time to go basking in Ukraine, obviously, but it's time to go and do, you know, but it's time to go and do things that bring results.
Yeah.
And that was the idea. So, you know, I grew up there. A lot of my friends are, you know, went on becoming other, you know, artists or musicians or, you know, painters, designers. Some of them became diplomats and, you know, work in other spheres. So between all of us, we had a reach to organize this and do it. And we were kind of basically logistically and legally guided by you know, these trusted Ukrainian sources. So it was very well organized. I guess you can't, I mean, I'm trying to sound like so methodical about it, but of course there is, we're musicians, we are emotional. So once we got there, it was actually unbelievably cathartic, because we not only played for the battalion of soldiers that actually were one of the first to receive the enemy back in February. So these, you know, these people like faced the brutality of the very first attack, you know, bringing joy to them and, you know, having some time to talk afterwards and, you know, kind of rubber, you know, sweaty shoulders next to each other and exchange, you know, some, you know, uniforms and just little gifts. You know, it was really, really moving on that level. But we also were very blown away by the musicianship of the military band, because it was a jointed gig. There was, you know, soldiers from the military enjoying the gig, but we also played with, I think it was about 6 or 7 musicians from the army forces. And when this gig was coming together, you know, we loved the idea. You know, we learned some of their songs, they learned our songs, but, you know, we still were kind of, we didn't know what kind of musicians they really were. Like, were they going to be mostly brass musicians that have like gigantic, you know, like tubas and that kind of like, you know, military kind of spirited marching band vibe? But when we got there, these people were mind-blowingly seasoned players. Like, the bass player was this Jaco Pastorius kind of guy, you know, who was just like beyond Berkeley gunslinger, you know. And other just virtuoso level musicians of like rock and folk and classical schools. So we just like, yeah, this is gonna be amazing. Like, this is not gonna be this like thing where we're trying to make it work. It's like, they already, it's done. Like, we're gonna really enjoy this mutual catharsis. And catharsis it was, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're from Kiev, and it's my understanding that at some point you moved to the outskirts of Kiev, and that's when you discovered punk rock and the punk rock scene. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's not really outskirts. I mean, I was born and raised on a kind of almost outside of Kiev. It's Boyarka. It's a small town, you know, outside of Kiev, actually. But then I lived in Kiev, and then we moved once again to Obolon, which is a borough of Kiev that's kind of more remote. Well, at least, I mean, it is remote, but it's sort of like, I love that explanation because it really works. It's a kind of Bronx of Kiev. Like, if you'd live at the back of the Bronx, like closer to, you know, farther up, that was the feeling, you know. It's, I mean, I was literally living in the last building. Like, after that building of that borough, there was just a flat field and, you know, river, Dnieper River, and then the artificially created sea, Kievan Sea, and there it was. And then it's Chernobyl, you know. So it's like that. It's a real outskirt. You know, we'd go up on the roof, and you know, you look one way, you see kind of Kiev in perspective, and you look the other way, it's just prairies, you know, and then sandbars. And it was a really great place to grow up. Like, yeah, as a kid, you have all that ammunition of like taking it as it is. You're not like, you just take it as it comes. So we were growing up in like construction area, basically, you know, since I was 8 until I was 16. There was nothing, not even trees, just unfinished buildings, which were, you know, about 9 floors and 16 floors, most of the time. Just kind of projects, more projects, and sand. Like there was not a whole lot of payments, just, you know, from a subway. The first years when we, you know, it was a last stop on a subway. The Hero of Dnipro, the heroes of the Dnieper. Then you had to go through like sand dunes to get to your apartment for like a kilometer. You know what I mean? That was the vibe.
That sounds like something out of a dream, like walking out of a subway, then walking through sand dunes.
I mean, you could take a pavement, but it would like soon up to be two kilometer walk.
Yeah.
It was just like, all right, it's just 1 kilometer straight through the sand. You know, we just do that. It was like normal, you know, and just get to your building and, you know, take your shoes out and take the sand out and go up into your apartment, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah. So it was kind of very cool, I think, for our arts development, because in a lot of ways it was like living inside of a coloring book that you need to color.
Mm.
And we did a lot of that coloring, you know. That's why the music was so, music was the color, you know. And metal was, I mean, I was always in the music because of my father being so, you know, he grew up just like maniacally obsessed with, you know, rock and roll. And he passed it on all to me, like metal and, all that kind of thing. I was already into it when I was like 10 years old. But when the punk came, that was like I discovered my music. So I got my own record collection and kind of, you know, it was just music of my time, of our generation. And there was a lot of passion and a lot of, you know, our scene, I think, was pretty, pretty greatly informed. You know, somehow we just kind of, as remote as we were, but, you know, I was listening to like Dead Kennedys, you know, Plastic Surgery Disasters, which I think is their best album. That's like 1983, right? Yeah, but we had that, like, I don't know, maybe with delay of like 2 years, you know.
What were the other tapes and bands that you really, that really spoke to you at that, in that time period?
Right. So I was gravitating towards more, high energy and eccentric kind of punk. So I started with, you know, Dead Kennedys, like, of course, because they were just, yeah, it's an absolutely mind-blowing band. Like the first two records are just masterpieces. And then, you know, having a vinyl record was just something that's like, you really had to work for it, to go to black market, save all this money. I had some vinyl, but that was a huge investment. So most of the time, it was tape trading. And it was a really, really charming network. Like sometimes you'd see somebody on the subway, you know, in Kiev. And even if you were like 14 years old, you know, you see somebody who's like got kind of funky haircut, you know, you're like, just go up to them and be like, so you're like down with punk rock, you know? And they're like, yeah, like, you know, you want to like go to my house and like check out my tapes, you know? I'm like, yeah. And just people would hit it off like that because it was such a cult, you know? And then you go to a show together and meet another, you know, 50, 60 people, you know, that comprised that scene. And then you kind of vaguely know everyone, you know, how scenes work. And some of them have become like, you know, I kind of became friends with like kind of guys that were older than me and kind of became my sages and kind of guides into punk rock. So I would get tapes from them, like Sex Pistols one side, Devo on another. I would get, you know, the Cramps, and on the other side would be... sometimes it would be just something totally off, like Cocteau Twins, you know. You know, you kind of had not my cup of tea, you know, but people were like very open to things, you know. They were just kind of like, it's all punk rock, you know. And I was like, I like that kind of, as long as it was like super baroque and kind of crazy, like it was all punk rock. So, you know, the PIL was massively popular. Public Image Limited was just like out of control popular amongst us. I mean, those are the big ones. Then I kind of took, I think I went with a more of a, with these kind of older dudes who were like 5-6 years older than me. They were kind of pretty notorious characters in punk scene in Kiev. Costa Baton and Mandron, like they were just kind of like amazingly knowledgeable guys. And I started listening to more GBH and like kind of proto hardcore bands, mm-hmm. you know, who are just less eccentric but more energetic. And you know, Exploited and all this like Punk and Disorderly compilations, you know, like One Way System, Discharge, all the bands that kind of UK bands that then, as I found out later, kind of influenced the birth of like hardcore music in the States. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I kind of was like, got on the train like back in Ukraine on that like proto-hardcore, Exploited and all that kind of thing, you know. And then one thing that really blew my mind was that when Sonic Youth came from New York City and played a show in Kiev in 1989, it was like just so out of the blue, like nobody knew who they were, and their music was kind of really singular, you know. But I was just kind of like, I think they were, you know, I met them when they were there. I mean, I was just like one of the skinny, you know, scrawny guys in a leather jacket at the show backstage that didn't speak any English. But I think that the word, first time I heard word hardcore, I think was probably from Thurston, from Sonic Youth. But I think he said artcore, but I thought he said hardcore. You know? But later on, I was reading like interview with him, and he was saying how he thinks they're more like artcore band, and which is totally accurate for Sonic Youth. But it kind of got hardcore on my radar, you know.
Yeah.
And the most amazing thing, as you know, about punk music is just so rapidly. It was so rapidly evolving that, you know, every 2 weeks there was some kind of new streak of it. Seemed like you would get new tape or somebody would tell you like, oh yeah, that like that whole thing is like finished, like just like shave your mohawk and like it's now it's this thing, now it's like Hare Krishna hardcore. that's the latest thing. Now it's like Youth of Today and Shelter, you know. Like that's the thing. You're like, oh, I gotta check it out. I mean, I don't know if I'm gonna like fully go out there and, you know, embrace the ideology of it, but it's pretty impressive, you know, how intellectually explosive it is, you know?
Yeah.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
You mentioned ska being something that you were aware of and even incorporated back in those days. What were the bands you were aware of?
Yeah.
Selector.
Mm-hmm.
The Specials, of course, you know. Something that had the kind of street vibe, you know.
Yeah.
Something that didn't sound so pedantic, you know. And Bad Manners were awesome. Murphy's Law has a lot of ska element. I mean, it's hardcore band, but I think it's just a great band any way you look at it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like such a great, it's just great band that has great songs, you know, fun stories, fun storytelling songs, like, and a really proper arrangements. It's quite a work of art, you know, like Murphy's Law, you know, if you like really know all the kind of vitamins that they come from. But it's we played with Specials actually several times, and it was really cool. In Europe, we played festival twice together, and we hang out with them. And I remember, maybe it was their bass player, but one of the original members for sure. Anyway, we had this really cool talk where he was like, listen, first time I heard Gogol Bordello was on Jules Holland show, and I was like, what the fuck? This is like, it's like these dudes just like stole a bass line from us, you know. Then they like have this kind of like, you know, Beatles, David Bowie kind of like Led's, you know, backup singing going on. And then, you know, the singer is just kind of just fucking punk rocking it out. And it's got this little bit of gypsy music, and it's got like all this, and he just got kind of like went to this analytical breakdown. It was really interesting to listen. And I was listening to it, I was like, that was pretty accurate. I mean, we're playing Lella Palatute actually on Jules Holland, and that's what he saw. So the bass line there actually is kind of like Specials. It's you know, I was like, dude, you're fucking nailing it. I mean, yes, you know. He's like, yeah, I mean, we do the same, you know, that's how it's done. You know, you just, you're your own synthesizer. And they just could directly see into a vortex of what we're doing, you know, musically.
When you were getting those tapes, was Op Ivy one of them?
Oh, Operation Ivy. No, I only heard Operation Ivy when I got to the States. And
okay.
I got here in 1990. So
it was still making the rounds in the US at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we did not have, you know, Ocean still, this was pre-internet, and Ocean was still working as a great divider. I mean,
yeah.
We just were not getting really a lot of American music. Like Dead Kennedys is just somehow, just it's like a force that was impossible to stop,
right?
Like nature could not hold it back. That was very popular. But like I didn't hear like Black Flag or Agnostic Front or Talk and Entry and or Gorilla Biscuits until I got to States. And then when I did, or Fugazi, you know.
Oh, okay.
And all of those bands, some of them became, you know, my favorite as bands of all times, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Fugazi and Agnostic Front in particular is just, I can't see myself without appreciating that whole, like, what they done. It's just too monumental, you know. But it wasn't, somehow that, I mean, I was the first person actually to send tapes with American hardcore to Ukraine. I would make these.
Nice.
As soon as I like picked up some equipment and Salvation Army, you know, we were still living in a refugee house in Vermont, and I started like communicating, you know, with local punk and hardcore scene kids, and they were super awesome. They were very. They kind of, we would befriended each other very rapidly, and they took me to the shows and they gave me the records. I mean, you know, sometimes they'd give me like 20, 30 records, and I would go and tape them and send them to Ukraine and, you know, trying to inform people and that, you know, this is the whole new, amazing streak of music happening here, you know. Yeah. Bad Brains, you know, like that really knocked people out in Ukraine. Like all my friends just like, yeah. You know, like three bands that really knocked them out was Bad Brands, Fugazi, and Murphy's Law, you know.
Yeah.
Because that was just like sonically it was so singular, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When you still lived in Ukraine, what were the punk shows like? Punk shows, right?
Yes, of course. In fact, quite regularly. But you are right if you're hinting that they were semi different, mm-hmm. because there was no venues. And I mean, a lot of the punk shows here were held in basically not in clubs, you know. Right. A lot of them were in like Ukrainian national home or, you know, Polish social clubs that were, would just get rented out to them, or, you know, some kind of gymnasiums. And but there it we didn't even have the luxury of that. Like, it was always in some absolutely super obscure place. And and when somebody said, you know, there was no posters, you could, like, you couldn't hang up a poster and be like, hey, punk show, like, that's like, no, like, you'd like be expelled from the, you know, college or, you know, school for organizing that show or putting up that flyer. People found loopholes around how to, you know, say it's going to be like meeting of youth or whatever the fuck, you know, like poetry reading, you know, you know, poetry reading with guitars and drums, you know.
Yeah, it's technically, there's poetry in the involved.
The production of it was like so, like, beyond DIY. It was like, you know, if we would hear, okay, there is a punk show happening at like 8 o'clock in this park or in this warehouse in that park, we would, people would go there like at 9, you know, like, and that means that like people get there, but the bands, even gear is not there. So it means that like maybe like 9:30, like the drummer, you know, shows up and starts like checking the kick drum. You know what I mean? Like, finally it all comes together and goes on for like half hour, you know, before it gets shut down. And you know, that was like, but it was still a huge event, because as long as there was, it reached the point of some kind of a eccentric burst out, you know, whether it was from people in the audience or on stage, you know, it was kind of like that. Like, it was more of a social event. And when Gorbachev, you know, allowed already like for more of these things to happen, more towards like 88 and 89, you know, you would go to shows that were maybe better put together, but people still there, even the punk rockers, it was still more like pogoing and kind of basically doing twist and shout kind of vibe, you know. That was already rebellious enough.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I got to States and I was just like, started going to hardcore shows, I was like, yo, this is like, this is a choreography that I have not seen, and I dig it, you know. Like, the whole slam dancing, crowd surfing thing just became like a regular thing to do. But that was not part of the thing back there, you know.
It was very insular, the Ukrainian punk scene. Yeah.
Well, it was just more like, it was just having like more like, the rebellious thing was like, have a great time, you know, despite like Soviet kind of grayness of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was different in that sense, you know.
So in 1999, this is when you start Gogol Bordello in New York?
Actually, it was more than like 97.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I moved to New York 97 and it started as a, you know, I just started playing by myself with guitar in Ukrainian bars on Lower East Side. But I already had another band before that in Vermont, which was kind of, you know, a hardcore punk band, and the Cossacks. And it was a very, very good band. In fact, we're constantly talking about doing some shows. Very much proto Gogol Bordello like. But I did kind of probably OD at certain point on the volume and just, you know, harshness of, yeah, I mean, I played the electric guitar and going ham at all times, you know. I somehow just hit this place where I just kind of picked up acoustic guitar and felt this like urge to do something very melodic, and you know, and so I turned down the volume, and Gogol Bordello was just kind of like, I was like, if maybe I can play these the Cossacks songs with acoustic guitar and see how it pans it out. And in fact, some of the Gogol Bordello songs, early ones, they were from the Cossacks. Passport, for example, was the, you know, the song from the first album that we still play every show. Immigrant experience kind of songs. And I was like, wow, it sounds really good, more like an acoustic, you know, punk rock. And so I kind of like, you know, stripped it down to that level. And then, you know, it became more of a duet with our very, very original accordion player, Sasha. And we kind of start performing like that as a duo, you know, at parties and some venues like Sidewalk Cafe, you know, that kind of like, it was a pretty legendary spot where a lot of people started out that kind of, I think Beck started out there, and Regina Spektor actually started out there too. Apparently, as we talked, turned out to be right around the same time with us.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just like Monday night open mic, and then if you're like caught a good vibe with Lutch, the guy who was curating it, you know, he would give you like an hour on a better night, just things like that. And so in it's kind of interesting, but there was never really time when Gogol Bordello really started, because it's kind of crossfaded from the Cossacks. Mm-hmm. And you know, some material from there, and me moving to Vermont, from Vermont to New York City, and then you know, Sasha, who was already playing with the Cossacks by the end of it, becoming like accordion, but also kind of like important kind of strengthening element in terms of like, you know, knowing the melodic pool of Eastern Europe. So, and then you know, it's just then became trio, and then I think probably you could say that like a real kind of like, if we would have to find a day, if we would have to find like a birth date for like documentation of Gogol Bordello, when the drummer Elliot Ferguson joined, then we were like, all right, we got the sound. Like, you know, when we met him, he was very into the Pogues and you know, punk rock, but also just, as he said it, hey, I know a good song when I hear it. So I was like, all right, cool, that's important. Let's continue talking. He just saw us playing at a party, actually, on Canal Street, our friend Adam Stannett, the painter. And he was like, it just looks so fun. Like, you guys are just having a blast, and the songs are good, and it's acoustic, it's just kind of really fresh. I was like, yeah, that's kind of how we feel about it. So let's join the forces.
So Gogol Bordello has, you know, even from those early days, members from all over the world.
Yeah.
Was that intentional, or was that just kind of how it happened?
It's how it happened. I mean, I really didn't have any intention for, we were not baking a cake, you know, with instructions and like, hey, let's have all these ingredients. That was not. Yeah, it's impossible to imagine Gogol Bordello without Sergei on violin, you know, but he was not on the first album because he was not in the band. He joined later. That's to the point that there was not, it was evolving as it's evolving, and it was more about not what people play, and it was more about like, kind of like characters for like the Magnificent Seven, you know, or something like that. Like, it was more important to have the like characters with great kind of personalities, and what they were playing was almost like secondary to me. It was just an always evolving idea, and it continues to change all the time. I mean, it was never the same.
Yeah.
So it's impossible to see without Sergey, but the first album does not have Sergey. However, now even I can't imagine it without Sergey, because you know, I went out and saw him play by recommendation of a friend who just like called me and said, "Hey, there's this amazing you know, gypsy violin player," and I was like, and I remember I was just so sick that week. I was just had this absolutely crazy cold that was killing me. I was just like, all right, we're gonna do it. We gotta go and see it. I just felt like this dude is gonna be an amazing character. So I just like guzzled down half bottle of wine. I was like, all right, I'm not sick, I'm just drunk. Changed the vibe, and then we went out there and met Sergey and wrangled him into the band. Basically, like 3 days later, he was playing with us.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just evolving as we went along. There was no map. Like, I wasn't aiming to get a violin player. I saw Sergey play violin, and I was like, yes.
The element of, you know, Eastern folk music and the kind of that we talked about earlier, the upbeats, that sort of dancey element has kind of been a consistent with the band, in even though elements have come and gone and changed and stuff. But it feels like that like fundamental element has been pretty consistent in the band.
Sure.
So after your first punk band, as it was changing, was that when you were going acoustic, was that always kind of part of how you were approaching it? Was that getting into that rhythm?
You know, once again, music doesn't come from deep inside of your brain. It comes from deep inside of other organs, you know?
Yeah.
And there was even a time when I was really trying to go so experiment, you know, with my own creativity and songwriting, just try to like write just ballads and really slow it down. But, you know, in the early times of Gogol Bordello, I mean, the first album is actually quite, it's upbeat in a lot of ways, but there is a lot of ballad strumming there. And like really drowsy ballad strumming. I'm talking about really, really, really drowsy. Just like super alcoholized, you know, jams, you know. And, you know, I really always loved, you know, songwriting of Nick Cave. So I was always kind of like pulled into that drowsiness, like certain part of me. So, but it's just really not who I am, you know. Like, I appreciate it. But who I am is a, you know, when you hear like super sped up Gogol Bordello, like that's who I am. You know, like, I experiment with other things. I don't, that speed is natural to me, you know. And even now, like I was earlier today working on a new song, which is a very kind of important song on the topic of Ukraine, and I tried. And therefore, it kind of, I'm watching that it needs to be pretty cohesive, you know, because there's a message there that I don't want it to get lost in translation. But, you know, I just, it's still sped up pretty tremendously. And basically every song that Gogol Bordello has as a slow song, there is a version of it that's easily convertible into a fast song. It's really more who I am, just energetically. And people, and you know, Sergey and Pedro and Boris and Corey, you think those guys are not maniacs or something? You know? No, I mean, they're completely like, they are hyper active individuals, mm-hmm. You know? Like, speed is their natural habitat.
I've heard you describe Gogol Bordello as joycore.
Yeah.
Which I think, like, this is where we can draw some parallels to ska, because I think ska is very much joycore, especially a good band. It produces joy, but it can often come from a place of processing pain, being cathartic, and you know, outputting it as joy. And I really feel like that's a really great way to describe Gogol Bordello.
Fuck yeah. You know, it is a kind of our private repertoire, you know, description, mm-hmm. of our band, but it's kind of nails it.
Yeah.
right back after this.
Let's talk a little bit about a few albums in. You have the song Immigrant Punk, and I think great song. I think it kind of captures the spirit of the immigrant experience, but in a way where it's, you're embracing it unashamed and you're proud of it. And same with La Immigrada that came 2010.
Immigraniada, yeah.
Yes. Now, I read an interview with you I think it was a little more recent, or maybe it was around that time, where kind of talking about how the immigrant experience historically has been one of necessity through displacement and through traumatic experiences, mm-hmm. Which was your experience, but that you were talking about the idea of a worldwide citizenship, which is that people can just be immigrants. They could just live wherever they want. And that the idea of sort of moving past nations and borders and just everyone being a citizen of the world is sort of like maybe the way of thinking towards the future. So I'm curious about your perspective on that. And especially, it seems like we made progress in that area, but it seems like we're backsliding as a world in terms of worldwide citizenship.
Yeah, it's okay. So this is like a very complex kind of topic, you know, and especially I already saw it, like, you know, kind of thrown in my face several times, where like, oh, you know, you were always talking about, you know, like, you know, that kind of rising above the borders, and here you are like advocating for Ukraine, you know, about the borders, you know, and which on the surface, to, you know, for sake of journalistic, like, kind of cheaper form of controversy, you know, kind of vibe, on the surface that can be like something to talk about, but it's very simply it's very simple to understand that yes, we are sliding backwards, like you just started pointing out. You know, when you live in a relatively when you live in those relatively all right kind of decades, like, you know, 80s and 90s and you know, early 2000s, you have a little bit of leeway there to fantasize about things that are good, like, mm-hmm. you know, you're envisioning a perfect world, and you're talking almost on behalf of perfect world, because you're able to sometime, I mean, those are also problematic decades, of course, but there were enough collective, like, optimism, you know, kind of turn of the century kind of vibe of sense of promise, where you think that things are, can get significantly better, you know, and you know, you can operate on that level, and it's very inspiring, and you psyched to share this inspiring visions with other people and exchange them with other artists. And there are people who really champion that topic, kind of like, you know, cosmopolitan idea, which I can identify with it very well. You know, that's very, that speaks to me for sure. But when you're like seriously witnessing entire planet going backwards, you know, in quantum mm-hmm. leaps.
Yeah.
And suddenly some of the accomplishments that you thought you could take for granted are just like suddenly not there, you know, it's, you know, you need to catch yourself and everybody else that, like, we're not living in perfect world. Like, we did not get there. Like, we're almost there, but we're not there at all. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, you need to readdress these topics in a slightly different way. You know,
people here in the US, I think, are aware of our own backsliding, you know, with Trump and his anti-immigrant rhetoric and people latching onto that. But anti-immigration is a global issue. It's a global backslide that's happening.
Yeah, well, because it's so complex.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, let's not make it unintelligible. If you really want to get down with it, subject, like, you will only succeed if you take a one slice of that subject, because immigration, people immigrate and people are refugees for very different reasons, so you cannot possibly ever put all of them into the same category and condemn them all or advocate them all. Like, it's mm-hmm. just like, you know, it just doesn't work like that. I mean, you know, the way we immigrated was, I mean, we're political refugees, so we had serious tangible reasons why we had to leave. How is it like the same with people who are just so loaded already where they're coming from, so they can just move to Soho and so they can, you know, live a more, you know, like live more lavish life than they're already living there. You know?
Yeah.
Like, how is that like even on the same boat? Like, it's not. You know what I mean? Like, and people very rarely sit down and differentiate those things for each other. Like, on the paper, both of those people somehow end up being immigrants and refugees, but like, these are people of completely different classes, you know?
So on the new record, you have a song, it's an old song, but you redid it, the Forces
of Victory.
Forces of Victory, sorry, yeah. So Forces of Victory, this song, I think, I'm assuming you redid it to address Ukraine, because you brought on some Ukraine artists to help you with it. And the song it has it's like more urgent, more, it's got like something, a new layer added to it from the original version. I'm just curious about your thought process about bringing that song back and how you redid it for now.
Yes. We had the album already done, basically almost. I mean, it was in final stages. We were listening, we were mixing with Walter Schreifels, who produced the album, you know, as you probably well know.
Yeah.
Awesome musician, great songwriter, you know, amazing legacy in hardcore and punk.
Yeah, Gorilla Biscuits, for instance. Yeah.
Yeah. Youth of Today. Quicksand.
Hot Water Music. Yeah.
Yeah. He even played in Warzone for a while. Yeah. So, you know, we were like finishing the album with Walter, and, you know, we talked about it all the time, you know, about that, what was in the news, having like a heavy X, you know, for everybody that, the Russia is acting very malignant, and so, you know, it was not really an option not to address this topic once the war actually, you know, materialized, and so we created several songs for the album to address this, and Forces of Victory is a kind of a maelstrom of energy. And, you know, it was very, like, I wanted to create something with maximum impact and fast, something that we didn't, you know, we could just cut fast to pull out instrumental tracks, restructure a little bit, and also make it in Ukrainian. So the new version is in Ukrainian and addressing people back home, and it is a collaboration with two other Ukrainian artists. That was the kind of, you know, the idea, like, create this knuckle punch of Ukrainian artists who are very different.
Yeah, Kazka's like a pop group.
Well, yeah, Kazka, Sasha from Kazka, she's a singer of kind of like a almost like synth kind of techno, ethno techno kind of,
yeah,
very interesting melodic band. And Serhiy Zhadan, he's a punk rocker from Kharkiv who is a super active in resistance. And, you know, we met years ago, and he's aside from being a punk rocker, he's actually an incredible writer who is from east of Ukraine, and he wrote novels that are made quite some waves in literary world circles. One of them is Orphanage, his novel, and he's nominated for Nobel Prize even before the war started. Like, he's just a legitimate amazing writer, and I just wanted to, you know, join forces with Ukrainian, like, powerful voices, you know, with personality who can move people. And that was really, you know Serhiy loved the song, wrote his own lyrics. He's a wordsmith from Lord. And we cut it very, very quick, very quickly. I mean, he also appears in a video. That's him, you know, rapping from Ukraine, you know, mm-hmm. in the video for Forces of Victory. And I thought it was just a great, really practical place to put our creative energies in. And since we're on the topic of in defense of ska, mm-hmm. you know, this actually Forces of Victory title comes from Linton Kwesi Jones.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Dub poet. And it was always one of my favorite records. It was just such an inspiring title that I ended up writing a whole, our own song out of it, you know. But, you know, I could not mention him in regards to that song, you know.
He's a genius, and I recommend anybody who's never listened to him, give him a listen, because he's a genius.
Yeah, it's just, it's something else. It's very singular work of art, for sure.
Yeah.
That entire album.
I've read that an influence for you is Manu Chao. Would you say Manu Chao is an influence on you?
I think that probably, you know, somewhere along being from Europe, it's easier for us to like cue in into something like Mano Negra. More importantly, Mano Negra, his old band, you know?
Yeah.
Because it has that pool of kind of Mediterranean melodies, you know, that
sure
leak in into our melodies. But I was always surprised how his music was just completely unknown in the States. Like, it's,
yeah, he's a star in Europe, and he's a star in like Latin America.
Yeah, definitely in those territories, that is a fact.
US not so much, but yeah. And you know, you listen to Mano Negra albums, and ska's an influence too, as is a whole bunch of other things. That's what, like, I could see a similarity, whether or not it was intentional or not, where Mano Negra would take like everything and just the everything was the paintbrush to make music.
Yeah, I mean, they were kind of going ham on that. I mean, it's all reached a point of like almost being tasteless, you know. They just were like, you know, like, it was more important to add more to the stew. It was like more is more band, you know. It was like,
sure,
it was just like very kind of and which I actually believe too, like, you know, any art student learns it, like, first thing in art classes, that, you know, less is more, supposedly. Yeah.
It depends.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. Less is more, but there's a lot of times when more is more. And, you know, and I think that, you know, we kind of proved that in a lot of ways. You know, just like having like army of people on stage, and you know, and just like having, I mean, we kind of go back and forth, of course. It's like we know what we're doing with our music, especially like the style has been so developed, and the so-called gypsy punk is just actually so much more than that. But is like I kind of know all ins and outs of it and what's gonna kind of work and what's not, but within it, but in a lot of ways there was also stages of just like throwing everything together and, you know, seeing how what's going to be the chemical reaction of that.
Yeah.
And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. And, you know, and in a lot of ways it continues to be so. I mean, as I said, it's all right that it's kind of continues to live its life and keep changing certain sides of it. That's the secret of its longevity.
Yeah, you have to do that as an artist and a musician. You have to, you can't just be complacent. I mean, I think you lose something, you lose an edge if you're not putting yourself at risk.
I have no idea how some bands just do that. I mean, no idea how those kind of more bands that kind of keep playing the same material. And actually commercially it's better because I can see so many bands just going out there and playing like their first record that was like awesome 30 years ago. Yeah. And like, and that's all they do.
Yeah.
And they just like slay it, you know, and like they're making a bank. And like, I could never do that. Like, I just like we don't do that. Like we do, we have element of, you know, the jukebox there somewhere where there is, you know, just a whole bunch of songs that people will not let us go without. You know, but, you know, I just, there has to be like a whole part of the show where like I don't know what the fuck is going on, you know. It's like, because it's like new and untested and uncharted, and
yeah,
and everybody's like knowing a band knows like, okay, this is the part of the show where we're like totally kick ass, and this is like the part of the show where it's like may fall apart any second. And and it's like, and it's awesome in this way.
Are you familiar with the band Ruskaya?
Yeah, we crossed paths with them, but we never played a show with them. I mean, yeah, I'm not really, I wouldn't say that I know much about them, actually.
Yeah, they're a band, I mean, they're a newer band. They started in like 2005, but they're based out of Austria, and they have Russian and Ukrainian members of that band. And they call themselves like turbo speed metal, but to me, it really is a lot of ska elements and like a lot of, you know, a lot of juxtaposing like different styles and sounds. I was just curious if you guys were knew each other or anything.
So, peripherally, you know, not on kind of, as I said, we never played together like a theater or club show, and which is where how you get to know people.
Sure.
There's a great band that has, this is really actually funny because I discovered, you know, every tour I go and I come back with like, a bunch of new music just people bring backstage and he'll check it out, you know. And I really came from one tour in Latin America and was checking out all this that music and really was digging this band, Cuatro Pesos de Propina.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, it's like, just like they got something special. It's got like all these influences that I love, and they do get pretty crazy at the same time. And I was like, well, where are they from? And like, what is it? You know, it ended up to be a band that played with us in Argentina, like several shows. And I just missed the band that was opening the show, you know? And more than that, I, you know, partied and got hammered with them after the show. Without realizing how awesome they are. So, you know, like later on I reconnected with them and you know, we finally established connection and start talking about collaboration. But you know, if I wish I'd known that then, because we would probably end up playing together on stage that night. You know, I absolutely love their music, you know.
Yeah. The back in I want to say 2004, you were part of the Kill Your Idols documentary. And when I watched that movie, I think I had become a fan of Gogol Bordello just a couple years before that, but and I like some of those bands in that film, but I felt like when I watched that, I said, oh, hands down your interview was the best. You had the most interesting things to say.
Oh, thank you.
About punk rock. I really like what you said about how like punk rock
is Trial and Error. I think that was like one that really, really appealed to me. And that what you liked about, you know, sort of the initial punk rock and what you were hearkening to is this idea that it was new and nobody really knew if it was cool or not. And that there was like there was a beauty in the allowance of that as an artist.
Right.
Where you could sort of just try things without that pressure. And anyways, I like that a lot. I like that. And I like that you can really see that in your band. I mean, in that particular documentary, there's like footage of you guys from like the Knitting Factory and you guys are going insane. And you're on stage with all, you know, all the instruments that people don't normally associate with punk rock and being way more punk rock than probably every other band that was on the show.
Yeah, that remains to be pretty much true. I mean, probably for, you know, certain people whose point of reference, you know, who are just a lot younger, you know, that they already experienced punk rock as kind of something more formulaic, like you get that thing and then you get that kind of look and then you're punk rock. But of course, the gist of it is that, is the great variety of what punk rock is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's actually pretty, there's actually very diverse kind of diverse culture with very many, you know, sometimes conflicting fractions of it, you know, and that's kind of the biggest beauty of it, because it's in a lot of ways it's dilettante, you know, it's people who just take up instruments and approach things in a very shortcut through the woods kind of way, you know, like I don't have the time to, you know, master all these arpeggios, but I have a message and here it is. Mm-hmm. So, and the eccentricity of it is, you know, the fun eccentricity of it, that, you know, how fun it can be, like I mean fun is important, you know, it's not like joy. I mean fun not in a meaningless way, but fun in a kind of endorphins pumping way. I mean, it's art therapy, you know.
Yeah,
art therapy that people can strike quite easily together, you know. And one of the appeals actually of punk ska is just how easy it is to start playing it. Maybe not for a drummer, but you know, that's why it sometimes gets bad rap, you know, because, you know, there's so much. It's just a lot of super dilettante people went and those, like, kind of like, what do you call it? Like, what's the ska wave that got the most bad press? Like the second or third or fourth wave? I don't know.
Yeah, like third wave 90s punk ska is like the stuff that people hate on the most.
Yeah. So, like, I think it's almost like maybe it appears like too easy, you know? But at the same time, it's just like, you know, you do your thing. You know, you gotta do what your true calling is, and maybe, you know, by starting it that way, you still evolve through it. And I mean, it's just a great place to dive into if you're a young, energetic person with tons of creativity.
Yeah,
you know, sky is the limit in punk rock. You know,
absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting because, like, in the mid-2000s, like, gypsy punks, I feel like, kind of caught the attention of the critical world, and you guys were appreciated. But then I was reading some articles for later albums, and I kind of felt like the way they were analyzing you guys was really bizarre. Like, they were, like, using the fun and the joy against you. Mm-hmm. And it kind of just, like, annoyed me. And that annoys me with music criticism in general. It's like, music, like... How music makes you feel.
Music is fun.
Yeah. And how it makes you feel is a very important part of the experience. Like,
yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, mental health is, you know, not very widespread thing. So, you know, it's like, you know, there's just a lot of people who are so lost in their head, and they're trying to describe something that they essentially do not understand. Like, they just can't have access to it because they're disconnected from it. Like, if you don't have like a vibrant emotional you know, life, you're not gonna like Gogol Bordello. Like, like, you know, you're not supposed to. I mean, I don't care, you know, yeah, whatever. As I said, like, we're not about like, let's get all the followers we can. Like, I don't care. Let's lose some followers. I mean, I'm ready, whatever. Yeah. You know, it's not, it's about like, you gotta be faithful to your true calling. You know, like our true calling is creating that levitation vibe, you know, and experimenting all the time, you know. So I'm not a big reader of reviews of our albums or really any albums. Mm-hmm. And I don't care if like critics like, you know, new Nick Cave album or new Quicksand album or not. I don't think I've ever read any of those reviews, actually.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah,
by mistake somehow, but
no, I think it's a good move not to read that stuff.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, plus every band, not every band, but in our band, we explored some visions that we were like, it was our vision, like, because there is no other, nobody did that. That's why we went there. That's why we kind of tried to, you know, take the best shot we can onto making fun, like simple punk, let's put it this way. Like, this sounds ridiculous, right? Sounds like oxymoronic straight off the bat, but especially like last, the album before this and Seekers and Finders, like the idea was like, let's drive this simple punk idea as best as it gets, or as best as we can, like, since we have like classical virtuoso guys like you know, Sergey in a band, and Pasha, and Yuri was always a huge like virtuoso and classically like trained musician, you know. And we did that, and we felt like we drove it home. And while we were doing it, yeah, I think there's some really great things on Seekers and Finders, but I can see how it's almost like a little too sophisticated for like somebody who is just into really like punk the fuck out, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like it was leaning into that, but that's what's the vision we were pursuing. And it's not a lifelong commitment, it's an album.
Yeah,
you know, we made that album, and while I was doing that album, while I was mixing it, I was looking at it thinking, wow, that really works, that really doesn't. And you know, the finesse and baroqueness of like virtuoso playing can work very well in certain punk rock contexts, like Forces of Victory, yes. But in some of it, it's actually those vibes rub against each other. Like the too much refinement kind of kills the punkness of it. Mm-hmm. And you know what I mean? So through doing that, you naturally arrive back to doing like really raw punk hardcore kind of felt record, like the new one, you know.
Yeah,
it's all part of the, you know, some different chapters of the same story. It's kind of, that's what it's about. Yeah,
I mean, we said this already, but it seems like you have, as an artist, you have to be willing to take a risk, and when you take risks, you don't always succeed. And that's like, I don't see why anyone feels bad about that. That's a part of the process.
Yeah,
absolutely. In fact, the best artists that, I mean, they all failed terribly yeah, most of the time, actually.
Yeah,
it's just like this mythology of pop culture is so fucking stupid that you know, where people are like, it seems you're like just like everybody's acting like your job is to constantly succeed. Like, it's not.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's not what we do. Like, people succeed when they succeed, and other times they spend developing that success by experimenting. You know, like, yeah, why is that not understood? You know, I mean, in fact, I feel very sad for artists who are like enslaved in charts and have to constantly bust out under so much stress, some numbers, you know, that it's just like, who wants to do that?
Thank you so much for listening to In Defense of Ska. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe to the podcast wherever you normally stream or download episodes. If you haven't already, grab a copy of my book, In Defense of Ska, available at clashbooks.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. It's at In Defense of Ska. And please consider joining our Patreon at patreon.com/indefenseofska. You will get monthly bonus episodes, extended interviews and commentary per episode, and access to the In Defense of Ska Discord. In Defense of Ska would not be possible without the great team that tirelessly works on it every week. So you should go check out their other projects as well. Co-host Adam Davis has an amazing band called Omnigon. Give them a follow on Instagram and Twitter. It's simply @Omnigon. And our editor, Chris Reeves, has a phenomenal record label and podcast called Ska Punk International. For more information, go to skapunkinternational.com. And if you've ever enjoyed one of the highly specific In Defense of Ska memes floating around the interwebs, it was likely the work of The Bands I Like Only Charge $18. Find them on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And on that note, we leave you by saying Ska now more than ever.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.